And we're about to celebrate an anniversary that may not exist. That's because reasonable people disagree about what exactly marks the beginning of the internet. We do know that 40 years ago today, two guys here in California sent a five-letter message over a primitive computer network. Some people say that was the internet's big bang. And NPR's All Things Considered will have a story about that tonight. For now, we wanted to consider what has flowed from that very first message.
You on YouTube?
No, Hulu. You?
iTunes. But I lost the USB for my MP3.
It's MIA.
Yeah. So is my GPS.
Ugh, I'm gonna lose it.
What?
This PDF won't show up on the LCD.
Call the ISP.
Or I could send them an SMS.
Maybe it's a cookie thing.
Yeah. I could look it up on the cookie wiki.
So you're on Google now?
No, Bing. You're such a Yahoo.
Yoo-hoo! I just got poked on Facebook.
Who from?
My mom. She wants to know if she can use PayPal on Netflix.
Hey, did she ever sell her iMac on eBay?
No, but she did get Wi-Fi for the Xbox.
Wait a minute. Can we have a real conversation?
Sure, I guess.
But can we have it in Second Life?
And that was a special presentation by Click and Drag, the Morning Edition players. This evening, All Things Considered launches a series looking back at 40 years of the internet.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today, we wrap up a series of stories looking at how hard it's become to keep your privacy in this digital age. Privacy laws really haven't changed much since the 1980s. What has changed is the nature of information. As NPR's Martin Costi reports, information doesn't really die anymore, and that is becoming a problem.
There was a time when defense lawyer Robert Perez did a brisk business in expunging criminal records. People who'd been acquitted would get expungements to wipe the slate clean and start over with their lives. It used to work pretty well, he says, but not anymore.
They find out everything. There is no such thing as privacy of criminal records anymore.
These days, prospective employers and landlords do background checks with private databases, databases that could contain old criminal records regardless of the expungement.
It's a big problem because these people are being confronted by the situation where they've told an employer, as they're entitled to, that this never happened. The employer has conflicting information. They don't get the job and they never learn why.
And it's not just court records. 2 years ago, a California lawyer Googled his own name and it came up with a 25-year-old campus newspaper article about him getting charged with theft. He sued, saying the college hurt his reputation when it put the newspaper archives online. The suit was thrown out, and now when you Google his name, you can read all about that.
Everything you've done is now preserved forever in the world of Google.
Jeff Moss has lived this reality a lot longer than the rest of us. His personal information has been floating around since before most people ever heard of the internet, since the 1980s, when he was one of those teenage hackers.
That's called pulling your docs. Somebody pulled my docs and posted them. Just other hackers screwing around with me.
Since then, his personal data, like his social security number, have just been part of the searchable universe.
Once they're out, they're out. Maybe that's why I care more about it.
Moss is now a prominent name in the world of computer security. And he says his extra years of online exposure have made him more cautious and self-censoring.
It's changed the way I talk to people. It's like I'm talking to you, but at the same time I'm talking to this wider audience of radio listeners, and I have to be aware of that. Same thing. You have to practice a defensive form of communication.
Moss doesn't see a fix for this. Information lives forever now. End of story. Or maybe not.
I'd like to send you some sensitive email. I'm just going to write some sensitive.
Roxana Jambasu, a Romanian computer science grad student at the University of Washington, sends me a note from her Gmail account. But this is an email with a difference.
This message will self-destruct after 8 hours.
It won't blow up, a la Mission Impossible, but it will become useless.
After the timeout, you will not be able to ever read the message again.
It's part of a system she's developed called Vanish, which lets you determine the lifespan of data you put online, email, Facebook messages, whatever. When the time is up, all copies turn to gobbledygook, beyond the reach of Googlers, marketers, and court orders. Tadayoshi Kono, a professor working on the project, says what they're trying to do is give people a relief from too much memory.
Culturally, forgetting is very powerful. And as more and more of our conversations and our transactions go online, we actually lose the ability to forget. And Vanish empowers users to be able to forget.
The key to privacy is forgetting. The idea is appealing in its simplicity. But the system itself isn't that simple to use, at least not yet. Right now, Vanish is most useful to professionals, say lawyers who want online negotiations to evaporate with time. And there's also reason to believe that no technology can really solve this problem, that it's the culture that's going to have to adapt. Jeff Moss, the grown-up hacker, predicts that future generations will simply have a higher tolerance for embarrassing information. And maybe we'll just be compelled to be more honest. Lawyer Robert Perez, for instance, now counsels his clients to come clean about their arrest record, even if it has been expunged.
I've heard too many horror stories about people who have been caught in the lie. That is the effect. That's one of the principal effects of living in the post-privacy world.
Nowadays, instead of an expungement, Perez writes the client a detailed letter explaining all the circumstances of the arrest, trial, and acquittal. For the time being, at least, we now live in an age of full disclosure.
That's NPR's Martin Kosty. And Martin, let's talk a little bit about some of the issues raised here. Part of the problem, it seems to me, is that all of this information is propagated so many times as it's transmitted over the internet.
That's right. I mean, you take the example of an email. An email doesn't just exist in your inbox. It's copied multiple times along the way. It lives on different servers, on third-party servers. And that's the problem, is when information ends up in third parties' hands, what happens?
Legally, Martin, is it still your own private email?
Well, not really. It's not really your private email or your private photo or your document, whatever it is that's been sent along, if it's not in your control. And tech companies that host a lot of this information, the Google documents or the Flickr accounts, for them this is a big unresolved problem. I talked about this with Alan Davidson, who's Google's main guy in Washington, D.C.
Today, if we keep a calendar or a checkbook in our desk drawers, it receives high protections from the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment. When you take that same information and put it on somebody else's servers, you lose many of those protections. And that is something that most people are not expecting. We need to make sure that people understand it, but what we really need to do is update the law.
And the thing is, the laws in the U.S. that apply to these kind of privacy issues, they date back to the 70s and 80s. And that was a time when people really couldn't even picture what we do with data now. For example, you probably heard of Google Docs. It's basically a document, it's like a Word document, except it's a Google document, that sits on another server somewhere. You have access to it, you write it, you edit it, but other people can also collaborate and write and edit that. Now, if that's a stored document, the law gives it a lower standard of privacy. But if it's a form of communication, then it gets a higher standard of privacy. The law is completely befuddled. It doesn't really understand. It doesn't have the definition or the terms for what we do with our data today. And it's really fallen decades behind.
Which is odd because we've been on the internet for so long. Why is it that the laws are lagging so far behind?
Some people I've talked to say that we were on the verge of getting some of this stuff redefined when 9/11 happened. And then Congress lost its will to start restricting or changing the way law enforcement goes about gathering information. Since then, technology has just made leaps and bounds, and we're almost three generations of new forms of communication past where the laws were at that point. There are some people I talk to, especially, you know, even liberal-minded civil libertarian types who say maybe government can't even do this anymore, and in some ways people should simply be allowed to see how their privacy is being handled and vote with their dollars, so to speak.
NPR's Martin Kosty, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And you can hear the previous stories in our series and see a timeline of key moments that have shaped privacy in the digital age. That's at npr.org. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block in California.
And I'm Robert Siegel in Washington. On this date, 40 years ago, something called the ARPANET came into existence. And since then, communication hasn't been the same. NPR's Guy Raz, host of the weekend edition of this program, talked with some of the people behind its creation.
Charlie Klein's lonely moment in history unfolded inside a large, empty computer lab at UCLA at 10:30 at night on October 29th, 1969.
And I was 21 and a programmer who liked to program all hours of the day and night.
Nights spent with the SDS Sigma 7. It was a computer about the size of a one-bedroom apartment. And that one night, October 29th, Charlie Klein sent an electronic message from the Sigma 7 to another computer at the Stanford Research Institute in Menlo Park, California. And that transmission would literally transform the way we communicate today. But to tell the story of how it happened, we have to start with the context in which it happened. A communication revolution was happening, except that it was happening over the telephone.
This is the automatic dialer. Just listen for dial tone, insert a number card, and press the start bar. The Bell System automatic dialer dials for you more quickly and easily than you can do it yourself.
Telephones were for communicating, and computers were built to process information, to do things like payroll and crunch numbers. You're hearing the IBM 1401. It was a computer system about the size of a two-car garage. On a recent afternoon at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California, a few old-timers got it up and running to demonstrate what it could do. And what it could do was process about as much information as your cell phone, your old ratty cell phone from the 1980s. In fact, if you took all the computers in the museum's main exhibit hall, and we're talking about a space the size of 4 football fields.
It's fair to say that your BlackBerry has more computing power than all of the computers in this room combined.
That's Bill Duvall. He was at the Stanford Research Institute on the receiving end of Charlie Klein's message the night of October 29th, 1969. Now, nearly 4 years before Bill and Charlie did the Internet equivalent of the moon landing, a man named Bob Taylor was sitting in his office at the Pentagon, where he worked for the department's Advanced Research Projects Agency, or ARPA, and he was frustrated. Taylor had 3 computer terminals in his office, and each one connected to a different computer in a different part of the country.
To get in touch with someone in Santa Monica through the computer, I would sit in front of one terminal, but to do the same thing with someone in Massachusetts, I would have to get up and move over to another terminal. And you don't have to look at this very long to realize this is silly. It's stupid. So I just said, okay, I want to build a network that connects all of these.
And so Taylor started to collect really smart people, people who could build that network, people like Bill Duvall at SRI in Menlo Park, Professor Len Kleinrock at UCLA, and the young Charlie Klein. Taylor also sent word to the biggest technology companies that they could bid on a contract to help build that network. Charlie Klein remembers what happened next.
IBM refused to bid, as did AT&T. They both said, can't be done, it's useless. They saw the future of computing as bigger and bigger mainframes.
So a smaller company, Bolt, Beranek, and Newman, got the contract, and it built a device called the IMP, the Interface Message Processor. It was as big as 2 full-size gym lockers. Charlie Klein explains how it worked.
So I would type a character, would go into my computer, my software would take it, wrap around it all the necessary software to send it to the IMP. The IMP would take it and say, oh, this is supposed to go up to SRI.
Think about it like your home internet router, only 100 times bigger. Anyway, it took about a year for BB&N to build several of these IMPs and then get them into place at different locations in the country, including at UCLA and SRI.
At some point, we were ready to test it. It wasn't like we had planned, you know, on October 29th. You know, we got to a point where I'm ready to test, are you ready to test? And we decided to do that.
And so late on the 29th of October, 1969, Charlie Klein, sitting at the UCLA computer lab, placed a phone call to Bill Duvall at Stanford.
We didn't walk into a darkened room, turn on the lights, flip a switch, and have it work. You know, this was something that we tried, you know, some number of times. Sort of, we were hooked up with a telephone headset, and we were talking to each other.
Charlie Klein started to type the historic message, an online communication roughly equivalent to what the Neanderthal is to the modern man. This is how Len Kleinrock, the man who headed UCLA's computer lab, recalls the event.
We should have prepared a wonderful message. Certainly Samuel Morse did when he prepared What Hath God Wrought, a beautiful biblical quotation. Or Alexander Graham Bell, Come Here, Watson, I Need You. Armstrong, Up on the Moon, A Giant Leap for Mankind. These guys were smart. They understood public relations. They had quotes ready for history, and we still remember those quotes. all we wanted to do on October 29th was to send a simple login capability from UCLA to SRI. We just wanted to log into the SRI machine from UCLA.
And so the first computer network communication was, well, it was supposed to be the word login, L-O-G-I-N.
So the first thing I typed was an L.
Over the phone, Bill Duvall told Charlie Klein, I got the L.
I typed an O, and he got the O.
And then Klein typed the G.
And he had a bug, and it crashed.
It crashed.
And that was it. The first ever computer network communication was L-O. The ARPANET was born. About an hour later, at 10:30, they got it to work. They successfully transmitted the word L-O-G-I-N. Charlie Klein scribbled some notes into a logbook and went home to bed. Bill Duvall also called it a night. On the way home, he stopped for a quick burger and a beer. Was that how you celebrated, I asked? No, he said. I was hungry.
That's our colleague Guy Raz, who hosts this program on the weekend. That's when you can hear more stories in our series, The Net at 40.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates spoke recently about roadside bombs in Afghanistan. Those improvised explosive devices kill many Americans.
And let there be no doubt that as long as our troops are in harm's way, the Department of Defense will do everything it can to destroy these IED networks and protect those heroes in the fight.
This week, we're hearing about the effort to find new tactics and new technology against roadside bombs. Now we'll ask how all these efforts come together on the battlefield, or don't.
NPR's Tom Bowman has seen that effort from two places. One was an intelligence center in the United States, where live video streams show the Afghan countryside. The other was on patrol with U.S. Marines in Afghanistan. Human effort and sheer luck mattered as much as technology.
The first patrol we went on, we saw, I think, three or four IEDs. They detonated all of them. And with one of these IEDs, one of the mine sweepers actually stepped on a pressure plate. It's a triggering device used to set off a bomb. Luckily for him, this pressure plate had no batteries in it, so it didn't detonate.
So you've got people who are not only in vehicles, but actually on the ground, walking around with electronic equipment, trying to find explosive devices before they go off.
That's right. What they use is a mine sweeper. It's similar to what they've probably been using since World War II, a handheld device. And it looks like what people would use on a beach to find coins or jewelry. And the mine sweeper, the Marine with that device, goes out in front of the patrol and goes out along the canals and through the cornfields and the paths that separate some of these compounds looking for IEDs. And he'll get a little positive. It'll start bleeping. What he'll do is start digging around there looking for what's called a command wire. The command wire links the bomb itself to the insurgent who's sitting there with a battery, and he puts the wires together and can detonate the device.
There must be no quiet moment or unsuspenseful moment when you're on a patrol like that.
No, it's very scary when you go out on a patrol, frankly. Sometimes they get some intelligence tips from people about where to look for bombs, but it is very, very unnerving. And for the Marines who have been here for a few months now, there's not a great eagerness to go out anymore, because every time they go out, they find at least several roadside bombs.
Well, now, when these Marines go out on these patrols, who's supporting them?
Well, there are a lot of new efforts, Steve. There's sophisticated aircraft with high-resolution cameras. They can spot an insurgent planting a roadside bomb or sweep up their cell phone conversations. And the Pentagon's also sending a lot more bomb disposal teams. They can pluck an explosive device from a dirt road before it kills American troops. And the Marines here say they're doubling the number of these disposal teams just over the next couple of weeks.
So you've got some of these efforts. You've got some airplanes in the sky, at least in theory. Could you actually have people in the United States gathering real-time information and getting it to a patrol in the field?
You could, and that's happening. The Air Force started what's called intelligence fusion centers. They have several of them around the United States and around the world. And what they do is pull together all snippets of information. It could be everything from an interview with an Afghan source, an intercepted cell phone conversation, and drone pictures. Because a growing part of this effort comes from the sky. And Steve, before I came to Afghanistan a few weeks back, I actually went to one of these intelligence fusion centers down at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. And you go into these centers, it's a windowless room, they have massive TV screens, they show live drone feeds from Afghanistan with running video of the roads in Afghanistan and suspected Taliban hideouts. Those images are sent by drones in piloted surveillance aircraft, And the Air Force says they have enough of these drones to provide 37 continuous patrols around Iraq and Afghanistan. General Norton Schwartz, the top Air Force officer, said most of these patrols in the coming weeks and months will be flown over Afghanistan.
The key thing here is fusing this. It's taking the optical imagery, taking the radar imagery, taking the human intelligence that our Office of Special Investigation agents might be collecting outside the fence.
All this information, Steve, is pulled together in what's called a wing operations center. And you go into these rooms and there are dozens of airmen, they're hunched over banks of computers. And I talked to one of the guys in charge here, Lieutenant Colonel Brendan Harris, and he said they send out hundreds of messages each day to field commanders in Afghanistan about the threats they've uncovered.
We analyze it and send it in real time or near real time down range. So people who are going to kick down a door, who are going to go out and find the IEDs, the improvised explosive devices that we're looking for, who are going to find bad guys, kill or capture the bad guys, or maybe just to a convoy that's going to transit a road so we can steer them around and save American or coalition force lives.
Steve, that all sounds good back in the United States, but here on the ground with the Marines, they say they've only seen one predator in the past 2 or 3 months. A lot of it just falls to the Marines themselves on the ground, getting out there and going on patrols with their handheld minesweepers.
Are you saying that there are so many efforts to get a technological fix on this, but in the end it gets down to one alert person or someone who's not quite alert enough?
That's right. It gets down to the Marines on the ground. General Larry Nicholson, he's hit his best weapon is what he calls the Mach 1 eyeball, a trained Marine who's been here for many weeks, knows the roads, knows the trails, and knows where some of these IEDs are being planted. And frankly, once you find several IEDs, you go back a day or two later, and generally they place the IEDs roughly in the same area.
Tom Bowman, I want to sort through a couple of numbers here. The number of American casualties in Afghanistan is nowhere near what it was in Iraq, so that sounds good. But the vast majority of casualties that there are have come from these roadside bombs. So looking at those numbers, does the military think that their efforts are working overall?
Well, what is really needed here is something you can't get very quickly. One is gaining the trust of the local population. We saw this in Iraq, particularly in Anbar province, where I traveled with the Marines many times. Once they got people feeling secure, once they got people trusting them, the people would turn over information about roadside bombs to the Marines. They just don't have that here yet. There's some first steps of people coming forward with a little information, but it's really not that much information. The other thing that's important here is they probably need more Marines here to cover this area. One thing that worked in Iraq was operation centers along the roads, where you could see down the road for maybe a half a mile to prevent people from planting IEDs. But they say they still don't have enough troops to cover the roads.
NPR's Tom Bowman is at a U.S. Marine base in southern Afghanistan. Tom, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
When that first exchange over ARPANET took place 40 years ago on this day, only a handful of people cared much about the event. On October 29, 1969, here's what was news.
The Supreme Court ordered Mississippi to desegregate its public schools.
The obligation of every school district is to terminate dual school systems at once and to operate now and hereafter only unitary schools.
That was CBS's Daniel Shore. No one knew on that day that he would be NPR's senior news analyst these four decades later.
Also in the news, the day the Internet was born, Senator Ted Kennedy was in Congress debating the Vietnam-era draft law.
Let me make plain my own view that extensive changes in the draft system are what we need. It will do no good in the long run to add yet another patchwork change to an already outdated law.
On the same day, a New York City bank equipment executive predicted that within 5 years, Americans would be using fewer checks because everyone would have a new charge card that withdrew directly from their checking account.
And in the week that the Internet was tested, a film starring Robert Redford and Paul Newman hit theaters.
I'll jump first.
Nope.
Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim.
Why, are you crazy? The fall will probably kill you.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid went on to become the top-grossing film of 1969 and won 4 Oscars.
And on this 40th anniversary of the Internet, we have a question for you. What was your first Internet experience?
Write to us at npr.org. Please put the words Internet at 40 in the subject line.
I can turn a gray sky blue. I can make it rain whenever I want it.
This is our final memory from October 29th, 1969, the number one song in the country that day, I Can't Get Next to You by The Temptations.
But my life is incomplete and I'm so blue, 'cause I can't get next to you.
Can't get next to you, baby.
Next to you.
Can't get next to you.
Just can't get next
can't
to you.
Can't get next to you, baby. I can't get next to you.
I can fly like a bird in the sky.
Also here in L.A., another change. The city has voted to overhaul its email system, converting all of it to Gmail. And that's a victory for Google, which is trying to replace Microsoft applications in government cubicles everywhere. Rob Schmitz of member station KQED reports that some in L.A. are concerned about how the data on Gmail will be stored.
L.A. will spend more than $7 million to switch to Gmail, making it the first city in the country to convert its entire email system to Google software. Washington, D.C. uses Gmail on a limited basis. For some in Los Angeles, being a pioneer can be nerve-wracking.
There's no place you can go in the world and say, let me look at it.
Bernard Parks is an L.A. City Council member. He voted to approve the Google contract, but he's nervous. The move means the city will start to store public data on remote servers instead of internal ones. This is called cloud computing. It represents a new trend in data storage, and it's at the center of Google's business strategy. The company has plans to create a government cloud, remote servers securely located throughout the U.S. that would store public data. David Gerard, president of Google's enterprise division, insists the data will be safe.
Their data is their data, not ours. We have no rights to distribute that data or data mine it or use it in any other way other than to provide, you know, the designated service to the city of Los Angeles.
Plus, says Gerard, the move to Gmail will save L.A. millions in the long term. Google is keenly aware of the economic times, says Richie Jennings, analyst for Ferris Research in London. So Google is beginning to market its software to business and government as an affordable alternative to Microsoft applications.
So it's strategic from Google's perspective because they want to be taken seriously, not just in the small medium enterprise, but also in the large enterprise, and they want to be taken seriously for government work.
Google was certainly taken seriously by Microsoft. The software giant sent lobbyists to L.A. to try and persuade the city that the move to Google would be a reckless one. Google's lobbyists were there, too, defending the company's reputation in the industry. Councilman Parks, though, still has some questions.
Well, they have a good reputation in the industry, but I think we have to identify what their industry is. And their industry, from what I can determine, is primarily ad sales.
In fact, 97% of Google's revenue comes from ad sales. Still, in this brave new world, more companies like Google are handling private and public data. It's cheap, it's easy, and it's a legal gray area. And it raises questions about what happens to your data when it travels into the cloud. For NPR News, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.